This Edgar Profiles podcast is supported by Ping. Edgar is an association of national federations formed in the year 2000 to develop and encourage initiatives which raise the awareness of golf, both as a participation and competitive sport for individuals with disability. For more information about Edgar, please visit edgargolf.com. Your host for this episode is Tony Bennett. Ping. Play your best.
I'm Tony Bennett. Before I start, I would like to tell you a short, personal, and true story about Ping. The year is 1982. It is a Saturday. I am playing on the South African Sunshine Tour and have just finished the last round. Yes, tournaments finished on Saturdays in those days. I'm hitting a few balls on the range while I wait for my travelling companions to complete their rounds so that we can set off to drive to the next event. Next to me is an American professional swinging some unusual looking clubs. I moseyed on over and watched him hit some shots. Eventually we started a conversation and I ended up hitting some shots with his clubs. I was amazed. Even my miss hits went straight. We agreed to swap clubs at the end of the tour, and so my journey with Ping started. 1982 was a very good year. I met my wife, and Ping helped me to play my best. From his early career as a DJ in the late 70s with a pirate radio station, José Bagnarelli has spent most of his working career within the radio and TV industry. In his early days, José worked with NRC, Radio Luna, and Radio Montestella, which was one of Milan's most popular radio stations. For most of the 80s, José worked in the USA, hosting and directing weekly music, sports, and entertainment reports, all aired inside a popular music show called Popcorn. José tells us how a chance meeting with an English gentleman changed his perception of golf, encouraged him to give golf a try, and how today golf is an important part of his life. His self-deprecating sense of humour is disarming, as he talks about his gimme three and a half attitude and how he almost took a shower when pouring a glass of water with his left hand. José now runs an award-winning audio production company based in Milan called Etc., which specialises in voiceover recording and sound design for radio and TV commercials. Clients include advertising agencies, production companies in France, in Italy, the Netherlands, the UK and the USA. José also holds workshops and seminars on communication for the radio and effective use of audio. Welcome, José. Thank you very much for being available to do this interview. Where am I going to find you today?
I'm in Milan. Hello, Tony. Today I'm in Milan as I'm in the recording studio of my audio production company.
Okay, so and what's it like in Milan? I guess it's a little bit cold, isn't it?
It is. It is cold. It's rainy. It's foggy. It's really not the best conditions to play golf today, isn't it?
I know that you were just recently in France, and that brings me to the very first question that I have for you. Uh-huh. Because I always thought that you were from Italy, but it's only very recently that I learned that you had dual nationality. Can you tell me how that came about?
Well, my family name is definitely Italian, Bagnarelli. And this is because my dad was from Naples, but my mom is from Paris. So I presume they coped with the differences by living in the middle, as I grew up both in Nice in Côte d'Azur and Milan.
Right.
Then I gained, obviously, double nationality, two languages and French and Italian culture. I was lucky.
Right. And I won't ask you then which culture that you enjoy the most, because I'm sure that both are very much special to you.
Well, you know, in my family, the two cultures used to be a problem when we had soccer games like France-Italy. My mother was on one side, my father was on the other, and it was they were always fighting. And after a few minutes, my father was in another room watching on his own the game.
And so, did you go to school in Milan?
Yes, yes, I did. I grew up in France, in Nice, until I was like 9, 10 years old. Then I did all my school in Italy. Yeah.
When you were at school, did you play much sport?
I have been playing sport since I was 6 years old. Gymnastic first, then I did some competitive swimming for five years. And then at 14, I entered in the Inter of Milan youth team, soccer team.
Okay.
Until they found out, I have to say very quickly, I wasn't able to play football. So, and I then played basketball, reached quite a good level. That was Italian third division. And I used to play as a playmaker and guard. In basketball.
Okay, so you and I have a little shared background then, as I also played basketball.
All right. Well, you're tall, aren't you?
So. Yeah, well, I'm pretty tall, and so it was pretty easy for me to play, and I was pretty tall even when I was young, so mm-hmm. I'd done most of my growing really between 14, 15, 16 years of age, and so I was much taller than everybody else in the school.
All right.
Can you remember what you wanted to do when you first left school for either a living or a profession?
Mm. I was lucky because I was in the right place at the right time when I was 16 years old, when I was still in the high school. And that's where I started my radio DJ career in Milan, Milan's first pirate radio. This is why I'm still working here in a production, audio production company. After more than 40 years, I'm still having fun with audio production and communication. So it, you know, when I was at school, I was already working. Let's put it this way.
So I guess this was kind of the equivalent of Radio Caroline and Tony Blackburn.
Yeah, absolutely. That's it. That was a few years later compared to Radio Carolina and those, you know, the radio that are portrayed in the motion picture, The Boat That Rocked.
Yep.
But that is the period. It was late 70s and pirate radios were quite a revolution all over Europe.
Tell me a little bit about the work that you have done, and because obviously you did your pirate radio and your primetime radio, as far as I'm aware.
Mm-hmm.
And you also did some TV hosting. So can you tell me a little something about that?
Well, my radio show on that pirate radio was airing daily from 2:30 to 7 in the afternoon, which is supposed to be prime time for young people. The radio show was quite successful. And this is maybe the reason why the Italian TV network Canale Cinque proposed me a few years later that I host and direct a weekly music, sports and entertainment reports from the USA. It was a very popular music show called Popcorn. So what happened is that I was 19 at the time. I then lived for the next 4 years, three, 4 years between New York and Los Angeles. And during that period, I was interviewing stars like Frank Zappa, Muhammad Ali, Al Jarreau, Sylvester Stallone, Magic Johnson, and many, many more. Well, that was a lot of fun.
I saw one of the clips that you very kindly sent to me, a popcorn show, and you had lots of energy. And I remember in one clip I saw that you interviewed John Paul Michael Glazer from Starsky and Hutch, who I remember watching on TV. Yeah.
Well, I was 19, so there was a lot of energy, I have to say.
But then came your motorcycle accident and all the knock-on consequences of that.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk me through what happened then and how it affected your life?
Well, my motorcycle accident happened just like, as now I understand, happens very often with motorcycle accidents, with most of them. You know, it was very simple. The guy in the car ahead of me decided to make a U-turn in the very moment I was passing him. So, the crash was unavoidable, and I just didn't have time to touch the brakes. And that's almost it.
Uh-huh.
And the impact was tough. I lost some phalanx of the right hand. The real injury was the plexus brachial, which is the main nerve of the arm, and my, you know, that nerve was severed in the crash, and as a consequence I had the complete paralysis of my right arm, and obviously I was totally right-handed Murphy's Law.
Has happened, yeah.
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 So it was tough at the beginning. It was quite difficult. I remember the first time I tried to fill my glass from a bottle of water, I learned how to take a shower, for example.
Yep.
With my left hand. I couldn't use it at all. But, you know, things happen. I did some surgeries later on. I did three microsurgeries and... some of the cut nerves were restored, at least enough to grab a beer from the fridge.
Right.
And that's basically it.
Yeah.
I would say that I learned from that, like everybody else, I learned a lot of things. First of all, I learned to be a lefty.
Right, yeah.
And some says that it works on the right hemisphere of your brain. So that means that before I wasn't using it, so it's not so bad. And definitely I would never have done things that I did afterwards, including golf, for example.
So when you had this accident, did you pass out?
Oh, yeah.
Did you have a period in hospital or something after that?
Yeah, I passed out and I found right immediately when I woke up, I was still in the middle of the streets. And I understood immediately that there was something wrong with my hand.
Okay.
Actually, I remember screaming in the middle of the streets, things like, my fingers, where are my fingers? Everybody reassured me, but then I found out a few days later that my fingers were still missing. And a couple of weeks later, I knew the problem with my right arm was really serious. Yeah, that's what happened. Yeah, I stayed for quite a long time in the hospital because I also had a few other injuries to my legs and to the other arm. It was really a tough. I remember riding at 100 something kilometers per hour when I had my accident. I didn't even touch the brakes, so... I was lucky. I was really lucky. Plus, the funny thing about it is that just 1 month before my accident, helmets were not mandatory in Italy. And I probably would have died if I didn't wear an helmet.
Did you previously ride your motorcycle without a helmet?
Oh, yeah. Until 1 month before, I was driving motorcycle. It used to be, you know, nowadays you say this and nobody believes it because everybody has now the consciousness of how important is a helmet. But at the time, it wasn't at all, just like the seat belts.
Right. I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, and I think in Italy, you could ride a motorcycle without a helmet until 1986 or 87, something like that.
And how old were you when you had your accident?
I was 27.
Right, okay.
I was 27 years old when I had my accident. I was back in Italy after my 4 years period in the United States. It was only 2 years that I was back in Italy, something like that.
It's interesting that you say you were lucky,
yeah.
And I think that... when people from the outside, oftentimes they don't even think that someone with a disability is lucky. But when you speak, and when we speak to the guys that have acquired a disability, such as yourself in an accident, you feel that you are in fact lucky. You actually talk about this kind of gimme three and a half attitude. Can you explain to me a little bit about that?
Well, it's the you know, everybody says, hey, gimme five. After my accident, I started saying, hey, give me three and a half.
Right.
That's basically it. If you're used to high five with friends and then you lose two or three fingers, why should you stop greeting your buddies when you meet them afterwards? You know, I just have to cope with what happened to me and try to go on with it.
Right.
Actually, since the very first day of my accident, self-mockery helped me to go through the new course of my life. It really helped me a lot. You know, things like secondhand guitars, I was always there. You never know.
Right, yeah.
Things like that. In a certain sense, it's a sort of self-defense, I would say. It's like saying, you don't need to be embarrassed or worse, since I am the one who is making jokes on myself.
Yep. Yeah. You seemingly have a very positive attitude. Is that something that you've always had? When I look at the clip that you sent from Popcorn, mm-hmm. you seem to be kind of energetic, positive, vibrant. Is this how you've always been?
Yes. But it really was also something that helped me to survive. So somehow I exaggerated it, probably, I would say. But it really helped me a lot. But it was my nature.
Yeah, and I think it's something that we see a lot, and it's not just in people with disability, in that people that are able to look at themselves and laugh at themselves occasionally, they tend to have a much better handle on things, I think, than perhaps those who tend to take themselves too seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Had you played any golf before your accident, or was it new to you?
It was totally new. I never played golf before my accident, and for like a few years, like 2-3 years, you know, at the time when I had my accident, I was living next to a golf course. But obviously, you know, probably at that time of my life, it wasn't really my cup of tea.
Just to go with that a little, why had you not played golf beforehand? Why did you think that it was not your cup of tea?
Well, because at the time I was already involved in very physical sports, and maybe also because I probably had an attitude toward golf, thinking it was a non-sport, or thinking of it as an elitistic or snobby game. You know, those kind of attitudes that I found out to be wrong, but afterwards.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so what was the reason that golf started to be attractive to you then? How did you start to get involved in the first place?
Well, I like to say that golf bumped into me. I would say so, because during a vacation in southern France, I was with my wife, Sabina, and we stopped in a golf hotel to spend the night. So I wanted to drink a beer, and I went to the clubhouse nearby. And there I found an older Englishman. He was probably in his 80s. And he was sitting at a table next to mine, and he was smiling at me. And we started chatting together, and he explained me golf in just one sentence, and I was amazed. He told me something like, golf is the only sport where a rookie can beat the world champion by just playing at his best. And I thought that was a very good concept, with or without disability. And I was very excited, and that's why as soon as I got back to Milan, I was taking my first golf lesson.
Right, and how quickly did the bug bite? Because that first time is sometimes a bit difficult, but sometimes, and obviously in your case, something bit you.
Oh, yeah. It didn't take long for me, that's for sure. I was addicted to golf after 1 or 2 months only. But it was difficult when I started. That was 10 years ago, and I didn't knew about the existence of disabled golf associations and their coaching programs toward handy golfers. So at that time, you know, when I started, the pro at the driving range was showing me Tiger Woods videos instead, asking me to superimpose my swing to his. And that was very difficult for me.
Right.
Very difficult.
Well, I mean, that's impossible for anybody.
Yeah. I wish I knew there were coaching programs for handy golfers. There are a lot in Europe. You know, I'm very close to Edgar now. I really appreciate the fact that almost every handy golf association through, you know, every country in Europe has a handy golf program with coaches that are trained for that. I think this is really important.
Right.
Very important.
Yeah, it certainly is getting better. I remember a few years ago, I think that it was, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago, perhaps, Edgar started with a program that could be delivered all over Europe. And I know that some of the federations and PGAs have taken that on.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there are many very well-educated professionals who are able to look at a player, look at the player that's in front of them,
mm-hmm.
and to use the skills that they've got to be able to help them play the best that they can.
Yeah.
But of course, you also need to have some specialised knowledge when you've got different disabilities in front of you, and certainly the programmes now are much, much better
yeah.
and much more widespread than they used to be.
Yeah, it needs to be spread around. People should know about it without maybe even searching it. They should know about it. I think this is really important to maybe have, young guys know when they are still at the hospital that they just can do it. There is no problem in doing it. You know, Frédéric Cupillard, which is the French Federation coach and is also a coach for handy golfers, told me once that I should have learned playing one-armed and not with the two, with the second one, for example. Uh-huh. But obviously, how did I know? And nobody told me. So, because somehow my right arm now is... how can I say?
It affects your swing.
Yeah, it affects my swing, right.
And tell me, you mentioned something very important and interesting there. You said it would be great for the guys when they are still in the hospital. How important do you think that first month or two are from when you acquire that disability?
I think it is very important. Last year, I went to the Malaga Disabled Spanish Open. And I met a guy next to me in the aircraft who had exactly... the same thing that happened to me. Same exact accident with the motorcycle and same results. He had a plexus brachial who was severed. But the guy was doing kite surf before. And from one point of view, he was very depressed because he knew it would have been probably impossible to do kite surf again. Uh-huh. But then he didn't really know what to do. When you have an accident like that and you're in a hospital, you have a negative attitude. It's human. It's understandable. So it is quite important to know that you can do it.
Right.
Because most of the people wants to go on with the sports they used to do before.
Uh-huh. Yeah, right.
I would say this is the main thing. They are still not in the position to understand that they just have to change and they will learn something new. And they will learn something new about themselves and they will learn something new on a new sport. And that is quite important, but they have to know that.
Yeah, we talk about it a lot, that golf at the moment is not yet on the menu of sporting options for people with disability. Mm-hmm. We know that a lot of people play golf, and in fact, we know that almost every person with a disability can play golf. Mm-hmm. Perhaps even more so than perhaps any other sport. But
absolutely.
But it's not currently on the menu of options in the rehabilitation centres and the hospitals because they're not aware. And once the therapists become aware...
Yeah, I wonder why it's not so. Because like you just said, almost any kind of disabled can become a disabled player.
Absolutely.
Any kind of disability can fit golf.
I think it goes back to what you said earlier about the gentleman that was talking to you, that the golf handicap system is superb for that. And the other thing, of course, is that the ball is still.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you have time to set yourself, prepare yourself, and it doesn't really matter how you achieve the three things that are required to hit the golf ball well, which effectively are to get some speed on the end of the golf club, get it pointing more or less in the direction that you want the ball to go, mm-hmm. and then... hit it the least number of times possible, you know. So, I mean, that's about it, if you want to keep it really simple.
Yeah, that's about it.
But tell me, are there any specific moments on the golf course that you find particularly difficult?
Not really. Well, beside, for example, the lack of circulation on my wounded arm, which gets very sensitive when it's cold outside. But it's no big deal. I just have to wear an arm warmer like anybody else would do. So it's not really a big deal. Probably a bad angle to reach the green is more annoying to me.
Okay. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Happens a lot of time.
What have you learned about yourself, Jose, by playing golf?
It helped me a lot. Before I was saying that self-mockery helped me to cope with my imperfections. I would say the same about golf. It really is a sport where perfection doesn't exist at all for anybody. Even Tiger Woods is not perfect. Rory McIlroy is not perfect. So it is an excellent sport to learn from. The essence of the sports tells you that you have to cope with your game imperfections. And in that case, it is, you know, it is a sport that teaches you how to cope with your imperfections as well. Any wrong shot, and like I said before, there are unfortunately still more than a few on each round I play. But any wrong shot teaches me something for the next one. I like very much one quote from Nelson Mandela, who said, "I don't lose, I either win or learn." And I have to say, though, that when I had my accident, I really thought of my accident like being some kind of yellow card in my life. So I really learned from it, I have to say.
It's a great way of thinking about it, I have to say. And what does golf mean to you? Because I can feel that you're very passionate about the game. So what does golf actually mean to you?
You know, I'm going back to that English gentleman I met in southern France when he told me that Rookie could be a champion, the champion of the world, just playing at its best that day. And let me give you another quote, this time from Arnold Palmer. I think it fits all golfers, including disabled. And let me read it. It said, "There is no king of golf. Never has been, never will be. Golf is the most democratic game on earth. It punishes and exalts us all with splendid equal opportunity." I think this is the essence of this sport, the one, you know, the thing that really give me a chance each and every time I play. You know, when I start, when I'm on tee number one, I have that feeling that day, if I play at my best, I can do great things.
That's why they called him the king of golf. It was a great quote.
Yeah.
Do you have any heroes or role models that you've looked up to or that you've followed as you've progressed, as you started to play golf?
I would say I found them the first time I played on a European Open of the European Disabled Golf Association. That was 2-3 years ago. And I had the chance to see people like Charles-Henri Quélin, Juan Postigo Arce, Cédric Lescure, Manuel Dos Santos, Adam Wabi, Joachim Bjorkman, George Groves. There are many, many, many of them who play fantastic golf. And having the chance to see playing high-level disabled golfers like them has been really an incredible source of motivation for my career as a golfer. All of them really play fantastic golf, and you can tell it's the result of their hard work and determination, regardless of their disability. And in most cases, their disability is much worse than mine. So there's a bunch of things to learn from those guys.
Yeah, that's true. Out of all the things that you've learned from playing golf, and I know that I keep talking about learning from golf, but I think that it is it's an important subject. Mm-hmm. Are there two or three takeaways that you think might be useful for people to learn from?
Well, I would give you two keywords, which are hard work and lightness. It's all a matter of balance between those two words. You know, if I have to give some takeaways, I would say find a goal, work hard for it. But at the same time, I would also say don't put too much pressure on yourself. I would say leave your comfort zones, but I also would say never forget to have fun on everything you do. When you practice, have fun, enjoy yourself.
You sound very motivated, José. Have you got any goals or objectives in golf that you'd be prepared to share with me?
Well, as my playing handicap is high compared to the scratch guys, I'm focused on lowering it during the next European Opens. Next one is in February. In order to climb the EDGA net ranking. I'm also very excited about the venue of the next European Individual Disabled Championship in June.
Yeah, in Troyer, it's going to be a fantastic venue.
Yeah, I really hope I'm going to be at my best at the time. I hope so.
Yeah, well, it's good now that the European Golf Association recognised the championship. And certainly last year when we had the team championship, there was a very different feel. Mm-hmm. Because not only is it an Edgar event, it's also the European Golf Association's event. And of course, that brings with it a lot more prestige, a lot more gravitas. And so, yeah, it'll be great to have you there.
Yeah, it gives, you know, let me add, it really gives a sense to the whole thing, because when I go, you know, each and every time I go in European Disabled Golf Association Open, I find really competitive players, and there are great sportsmen. There are players, first of all, you know, I don't even see, when I play golf during those opens, I don't see myself as a disabled golfer, and I don't see the others as disabled golfers, but just like players, very competitive golf players.
Yeah, it was something that we introduced probably 4 years ago when we we introduced a strap line to Edgar, which was golfers first. And we just wanted to put let people consider that, number one, the player's a human.
Absolutely.
Then it's someone who, like yourself, you're a golfer. And then finally, we want them then to consider disability only after that.
That's brilliant. Yeah.
Are there any adjustments that you would think about making or would like to change to golf to make it more user-friendly, specifically for golfers with disability?
It is very challenging for every disabled golfer to be able to go in normal clubs and play with, you know, normal players and be able to beat them. So I think it is quite important to leave as much as possible those rules equal to, let's call it, normal players. I don't like that way of saying, but so I wouldn't change much. Maybe the only thing I would probably restore, the anchoring put stroke rule, the one that was banned in 2016. First of all, because everybody reminds of it like something that has been used by the pros, so I wonder why it was banned. But most of all, it doesn't affect my golf at all. I want to be clear about this. I putt in a normal way. I try to, as at least.
So you're having three putts sometimes like I do then?
Three? Yes. I'm doing some four putts as well, but don't say to anybody, please. Please.
Okay.
But I think it would be fair for, you know, there are some golfers whose disability requires long putters. They need to be, you know, anchored. Anchoring put stroke can be helpful for them. I'm thinking, for example, the one who had strokes, or, you know, there are some disabilities who it would be fair for them to play like the pros used to play just 2 years ago.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I think that it's something that the RNA have looked at and will continue to look at. And obviously the ban's a new ban, and when it came into force only, well, it's a couple of years ago. Well, actually, it's two calendar years ago. It really is only just over 1 year ago, because it's still January.
Yeah, you're right.
And so it's probably too new to make any adjustments. And I think that in the future, they'll look at it again and again and again. And who knows? We're not really involved in that, although we did do some research and passed it to the RNA for them to have a look at.
Yeah.
So you've got some good views and a philosophy on competition. And can you give us a little bit more of an idea of what these two things mean to you?
Well, first of all, let me point out something that I really feel like saying that we didn't mention. We always been talking about golf and what happened to me and competition, most of all. But I really feel like it's important for me to say that I found incredible people during those opens, really some great warriors, I would say, and some great friends, people that have an incredible humanity, and people that are open, that went through difficult moments of their life, and so they understand what is the meaning of life, and then can give it they can give it to you, and they can give their point of view, which is really important nowadays. So I needed to point that out, because I really found a lot of friends, very interesting people. And this leads me to speak about what I call golf islanders. There are golfers who go beyond competition and become really heroes. Not talking about Tiger, Rory, Justin, Lee, Sergio. I'm talking about Jean-Marie, Sebas, Terry, Christophe, Jürgen, Zepedro, Christian. There are many others who play on a par golfer. These brave athletes playing golf on an adapted wheelchair are amazing. I think those are the real heroes. Some of them play fantastic golf. Some other play good golf. And some of them are learning to play good golf, which the good thing about golf is that you're always learning and you're always progressing on your game. So some of them are really good, but all of them really lead any other golfer to understand what dedication to sport and competition means. And I think they show everybody that nothing can stop one's will. Nothing can stop them.
That's what golf is. I remember my father. My father's a golf professional. And I remember him saying to me, he said, "Tony, the first 30 years will be the most difficult." Okay, fine. Thank you, Dad.
Okay. Thank you, Dad.
And by the way, I've now been playing for 45 years and it's still difficult. He sold me one there when he told me that. But the beauty is the opportunity to learn all along, and you're always learning something new. And you made an interesting point again when you mentioned these guys.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about it a little bit earlier when you said that you felt lucky. And then again, a little later, you said that you felt that you'd be given a yellow card and not a red card.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that if we were to put this into a kind of a terminology, we could use the word a mulligan
as a
good example, in that the mulligan for golf is when you get a second chance. And it seems to me that's what you've been mentioning as we've gone through this conversation. Yes, you had an accident, but you had a chance to do other things. And the yellow card was not a red one. And you had another chance. And certainly the guys that you mentioned, I think they all seem to embody that kind of spirit that, okay, life has dealt me whatever and they've just got to get on with it and play the cards as they find them. So they've had a mulligan and they're enjoying it very much. And certainly I know that one of the guys that you mentioned there looks at it as having an opportunity to play in tournaments all around Europe and maybe also to represent his country one day. And this he might not have done in any other way.
Yeah.
And you also mentioned a good first take. And so I'd just like you to talk to me a little bit about that. What is a good first take?
Well, good first take, that's usually what it's said on sets, on TV or radio or production sets. You know, when you have a good first take, the director usually say, "Good first take, okay."
Oh, okay, I get it now. I understand where it comes from.
It is my contribution to a book published a few years ago where I was asked to write my early epitaph along with other personalities. And thinking about it, I came with that phrase, which is largely used in my production work. And I thought of this phrase as a synthetic combination of my work as I'm now director in my audio production company. But most of all, it is the sum of my life, of my, if I had to use a phrase to tell you about my life until now, I would say good first take.
Yeah, very good. I like it. Just a couple of general questions here now before we finish.
Yep.
Is there anything about you that might surprise us?
I don't know. It depends on you.
Okay, fine. Other than being a TV guy, interviewing Muhammad Ali, which I'm going to speak to you about later because when we get together, we're going to sit down, I'm going to buy you a beer, and we're going to talk about Muhammad Ali because he was definitely one of my heroes growing up.
All right. Well, you know, Muhammad Ali punched me.
Ah, I hope it was just a play punch.
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. Well, I don't know. I'm a normal guy, and I do a normal life. I work. I have a beautiful and funny wife, Sabina. I have two children, Bianca and Bruno, and I play golf. Oh yeah, I have two dogs, Rosina and Pinella.
What kind of dogs are they?
They're mixed. They're both mixed. Two girls. Rosina, we found her in the countryside. She was an abandoned dog, and Pinella, we just took her away from the bad guys who just said, "Hey, do you want this dog?" and we said yes.
That's good. So they've got a good life because of you. So which piece of your golf equipment gives you the most joy?
It depends on the days. I would say driver on Mondays and Thursday, though it's not bad. five iron the first weekend in spring. Yeah. I don't use it much. Maybe putter in the month with an R, like for the oysters, you know?
Okay.
I don't know. It's, you know, sometimes it's a good drive some days. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, that's the game, isn't it?
Yeah, it is the game. It is part of the game.
Tell me, if you could play a four ball with any three players, dead or alive, you don't even need to know if they play golf or not.
Okay.
Who would you pick and why?
Well, first of all, my dad, that's for sure. He never played golf in his life, but I'm sure he would have loved it. So he would be my first pick.
Did he ever see you play golf?
No, unfortunately, he did not. Now he's very often on my shoulder when I'm on tee, on difficult tees, it's next to me. So he's my invisible caddy.
Mentor caddy, nice.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nice.
Then the second one could be my wife, Sabina, who wanted to play golf with me until we got married. Then she stopped.
Well, she didn't want to know then.
No, I'm too hard on her. She just sees golf in a different way than I do.
Yep.
Let's say she wants to be more comfortable.
Okay.
Then I would say, oh, yeah, there is one personality I would like to play with. Iggy Pop.
Iggy Pop.
He's a fine golfer, but just to hear him singing Louie Louie on the course.
Okay.
That would be fun.
That would change the golf club a little.
Yep.
Okay. I've just got one more question for you, José, as I've taken quite a lot of your time already. So unless you've got something else that you'd like to discuss that we've not already done so. But just as my closing shot, if you could magically be with someone who has a similar disability to yourself, in fact, you said that you sat on a plane recently with someone who had just got the same disability. Mm-hmm. What advice would you want to give that person?
Well, since we've been speaking a lot about yellow cards and mulligan, you know what I would do, Tony? I would pour a finger of scotch in a glass and make a toast to him as he's still alive. Because that is the most important thing. That's what I would do. I wouldn't give him any advice, but just cheers him of being alive and having a second opportunity, a second chance.
Yes,
as you said,
José. I've really enjoyed chatting with you.
It was my pleasure, Tony.
Is there anything else that you'd like to discuss before we close?
No, not really. I'm intrigued by your father being a professional. I probably will talk about it with you later on.
Okay, so you can buy me the second beer, and after we've discussed Muhammad Ali, we can talk about my old man.
All right. That's a deal. That's a deal.
If people want to reach you, José, how can they find you?
Telepathy.
Okay.
Or by email. That's simple.
Yes.
José@etcetera.it.
Yep.
Maybe it's better to spell it.
Yes, we will put it in the show notes.
All right.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
José, I really appreciate you taking the time. It's been fascinating to chat with you, and thanks for making this possible.
It was my pleasure, Tony.
This is also the very first interview that we've done with a recording studio, so we're really looking forward to hearing how that comes out.
Oh.
And also, thanks very much for arranging the guys at your end who are recording this and
all right.
Who I assume will send the tapes on to us.
No problem. It was my pleasure and it was a lot of fun. And let me end up saying hi to everybody, to my friends, players, and to the future players. Go for it, guys. And I'll see you on the golf course.
Super. Thanks very much. And I'll see you very soon.
Thanks to you, Tony. Ciao.
This was an Edgar Player story supported by Ping, helping golfers to play their best. For more information about Edgar, please visit edgargolf.com. Stay tuned for the next Edgar podcast. Ping. Play your best.